ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
They prayed, they preached, they rebelled. From God Forbid, this is the Religious Rebels podcast, the stories of people who defied empires and sometimes paid with their lives. From Joan of Arc's battlefield visions to Malcolm X's final revelation, we tell the stories of those who defied faith and remade it. Religious Rebels, the original disruptors. Search for God Forbid ABC wherever you get your podcasts or on the ABC Listen app.
What do you think universities are for? The production of new knowledge or the production of job-ready graduates? Perhaps both? But can those goals conflict with each other? What about fostering a love of learning? Or the pursuit of ideas just for curiosity's sake and nothing more, with no practical or tangible or measurable outcomes in mind? Now, is that an elite indulgence or a fundamental human need? G'day, Natasha Mitchell with ABC Radio National's Big Ideas, and today on the show, as universities face political attacks and an identity crisis, what's the usefulness of useless knowledge?
I think we're actually facing a really interesting time. AI might give us a great opportunity because AI thinks fast. We should allow universities to let us think slow and let us think sideways and let us think in ways that the AI could never copy us. It's a really amazing time to think about how the university of the second half of the 21st century should look like, and it should be very different than what we see now.
The usefulness of useless knowledge is the title of a striking essay in a 1939 edition of Harper's Magazine, which I've linked to in the show notes for this episode. It's worth a read. It's by the influential American educator and reformer, Abraham Flexner. He wrote it in the face of fascism's rise and the outbreak of World War II, right? But he could have penned it today when he wrote, quote, "Is it not a curious fact that in a world steeped in irrational hatreds, which threaten civilization itself, men and women, old and young, detach themselves wholly or partly from the angry current of daily life to devote themselves to the cultivation of beauty, to the extension of knowledge, to the cure of disease, to the amelioration of suffering, just as though fanatics were not simultaneously engaged in spreading pain, ugliness, and suffering." And he went on, "From a practical point of view, intellectual and spiritual life is, on the surface, a useless form of activity. I shall concern myself with the question of the extent to which the pursuit of these useless satisfactions proves unexpectedly the source from which undreamed of utility is derived." Oh yeah, it's worth reading that essay. And it was that useless satisfaction and undreamed of utility that Abraham Flexner had in mind when he founded the world's first Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton to foster independent intellectual inquiry and academic freedom back in 1930. Albert Einstein was one of his first faculty. 37 Nobel laureates and counting have found an intellectual home there over the past century. Well, 25 years ago, the University of Western Australia set up its own Institute of Advanced Studies, the first and only here, and it's on UWA's Perth campus on Whadjuk Noongar country that I come to you today with the Institute's current director, the pioneering artist and founder of Symbiotica, the Centre of Excellence in Biological Arts, Associate Professor Oren Katz, the former founding director of the Institute, Terri-Ann White, who is also former head of UWA Publishing. Now she runs the independent publishing house Upswell. And early on in her life, she founded an iconic Perth bookshop called Arcane. Belgal woman, art historian and lecturer, Dr. Jessica Hutchins, is the co-director of the University of Western Australia's Burnt Museum, which holds one of the most significant collections of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander cultural material in the world. Let's meet them. All right, let's get cracking. I just want your first response to this idea that some knowledge is useful and some knowledge is useless. Terri-Ann.
I really like the idea that's out of fashion now, that failure is valuable. And so therefore, you know, what can happen in a university is people get together and start talking and sharing ideas. But there's a lot of failure attached because pathways are broken up and all of those dreams of collaboration fall into muck. What I'd say is the muck always drives interesting new knowledge.
Are you calling muck useless, what we'd assume to be useless at first glance?
Yes, at first glance, yeah.
So there's value in the muck?
Yeah, I think always value in the muck, yeah. Because people are talking to each other and it's so hard to get people to talk to each other in a university. That's what I found you know, when I came here from rock and roll and bookshops, you know, that people talk to their friends in their own discipline.
Well, you worked very hard to get conversations happening across the different specialties inside a university. We'll come back to that. Jessica, what do you think of this idea that some knowledge is useless and some is useful?
It's a tricky question. I was trying to think of it in an Indigenous knowledge context. And look, I'm sure aunties are very happy to tell you if you've had a useless idea. But in all seriousness, I don't think there is that distinction in our Indigenous knowledge systems. I think that the way knowledge is thought of is with a tremendous amount of care and responsibility. So if there is distinctions made between when you can use knowledge or when you have the right to use knowledge, that's based on these really deep relationships of custodianship and care. And everything on country has knowledge: plants, animals, people, sites, ancestors. And that gets really carefully passed on. But the thing that's not understood is that allows for the innovation, that allows for things like our incredible art movements, contemporary art movements that have happened, or our academics today, because there's such deep source for the knowledge. Mm-hmm. And so much of our knowledge was just seen as pretty useless when the settlers saw it because it got in the way of the economic expansion. But now I think we're starting to realise it's going back to that idea that everything has a place, so nothing can really be useless.
Yeah, and let's come back to what universities, what these academies thought of Aboriginal ways of knowing, Aboriginal First Nations knowledge. Oren Katz, so this expression, the usefulness of useless knowledge, comes from a Harper's essay that the founder of the Institute of Advanced Studies at Princeton wrote in 1939. What was he opining in that Harper's essay? So, what was his panic over?
So the main thing he's talking about is the fact that we can't have useful knowledge without the useless knowledge that is the foundation of it. He says every big idea came from people who were curious and just wanted to know things about the world without ever imagining how it's going to be applied and utilized. And this is how we find out new knowledge. He was actually quite derogative towards innovators. He said, those are just people that are piecing up together the puzzle of the knowledge that came before them by people who were there just because they wanted to know, just because they wanted to understand how the world works without ever thinking about how they can monetize it or utilize it or exploit it or extract value from it.
And this is a guy who employed Einstein as one of his first faculty members.
Exactly, yes. He wanted to create what he referred to as kind of this scholar's paradise. And his idea, and this is something that we all, I suppose all academics here, would strive to, this notion that you go to work not to do admin work, not to do stuff for someone else. You go there to basically satisfy your own innate curiosity that would then drive the knowledge that would be produced. And then some other people can come and make it useful. But we can't make it useful unless we start with the uselessness.
But did he think that the only value of useless knowledge was that it would one day be useful?
No.
That it one day would be applied?
So he talks about the idea that somehow we can also create knowledge just for knowledge's sake, because we as humans, that's what drives us, this curiosity. We're explorers. One of the amazing things, when I came to UWA and I saw the slogan, seek wisdom, it's the seek part that I was interested in. This journey that we are going to, just for the sake of the journey, just to see what's on the other side of the hill, rather than knowing that there's a gold pot there. Mm. We might be there, but it's the journey which is important.
Let me push back to you though, Oren. It's all very well for a bunch of learned scholars to pursue their passions and have the lovely enlightened life of following their natural curiosity at the expense of the public purse. that some people can't access education, and then we give you the enlightened experience of being an independent scholar at a university?
So, you know, I always say that kind of a health of a society is measured by the type of frivolous activity they're engaged in. And you can make your choices, but I think that frivolous activity, which is about the generation of knowledge that might or might not be useful in the future, makes so much more sense to me than so much other frivolous activity that especially nowadays we're engaged in. And the amount of money that is being poured, both the public and the private purse, towards those really futile pursuits that we all have to push against, because I think there's other types of pursuits which might be seen frivolous, but are satisfying to us as humans way more than engaging in brain rot constantly.
So what was interesting about this essay that he wrote back in 1939 was, of course, that was a time when fascism was spreading across Europe. And here we are. Oren, how do you see this moment compared to the moment that he was writing about?
So obviously history rhymes, but I would even go further back in a sense. We are running a major risk of actually entering a new dark age. And the reason why we're running into this risk is because we're only looking for what we know we're going to find, which was what happened in the dark ages. Beside the fact that we're also consuming nanoplastics that make our IQ much lower, and as ChatGPT makes us stupid and all of those other things. So we need to push against this. We need to create bastions against this encroaching dark ages. You know, when a politician says that universities and professors are the enemy, we need to push back. I think the way Flexner did it, he found a philanthropist that helped him. And so it wasn't even
to create an intellectual utopia. And,
yeah, exactly.
So, Terri-Anne, do you see this present moment that we're in as a kind of dark age?
Working towards a dark age, yeah, I do. I listened to Big Ideas a couple of weeks ago when my first university teacher, Graham Turner, talked about his book Broken, which is about the breaking of universities, where he talked about how, you know, at a particular time, probably in the late 80s, early 90s, and it's just got more and more intense, the universities decided to base themselves on an economy rather than a society. And so that just really limits what all of that frivolous talk and all of that
blue sky thinking,
people talking to each other about things that they know about and then coming up with ways to understand the world in, you know, through different prisms.
So what did change in universities? I mean, they became much more corporatized, but we also opened the doors to many more people to have access to higher education, and that was a powerful social change. Yeah. Perhaps it opened the doors of the academy in a positive way.
It most certainly did for the time that I walked through that door, you know, as the first in my family to go to a university. But then it just became slightly warped. So, and at that point, we started to bring in international students for revenue rather than for stimulation. And we employed a lot of people who were, you know, in a neoliberal sense, they were kind of either new to universities, they were really smart consultants, or they were great entrepreneurs or innovators, but the whole model changed to corporatise and commercialise.
So how did that change what sorts of knowledge, the pursuit of what types of knowledge got prioritised?
I think it was about the commercial imperative, projects and products that could be commercialised.
So a focus on the applied, a focus on the practical, a focus on the commercialisation. Jessica, I'm interested in this idea of who gets to decide what's useful knowledge and what's useless knowledge. For many years, academies were places that were run by rich white men, and they pursued the interests that they had. How do you view who got to do the deciding about what knowledge was worth its weight and what wasn't?
I guess to think about the formation of those first kind of Indigenous study schools or Indigenous departments, which were about really trying to provide that access to Indigenous students at the university, I mean, they fought an enormous uphill battle. They were revolutionary. at the time their knowledge was not respected. They would have other academics at the university telling them that what they were teaching wasn't legitimate because the lecturers didn't have PhDs. All kinds of things went on, and we still face some of those challenges today, of course. But I think we really have to remember these schools as activist places. And at a time, you know, when I was coming through university, there were lots of buzzwords around, you know, interdisciplinary knowledge and multimedia and creative methodologies just starting to come up. Mm. And the place that was doing that kind of knowledge production was in the Indigenous Studies School, who had completely experimental techniques in the Western lens, you know, because it was coming from a place where we didn't divide knowledge up into these really separate, discrete disciplines, but where we did things in a much more holistic way. So I think that's had some major impacts at universities across the country, those schools.
Yeah, has that way of pursuing or thinking about knowledge maybe seeing Western hierarchies of knowledge as not relevant or not appropriate, has that presented an interesting cultural shift for entire universities beyond the bounds of Indigenous departments?
I mean, I know the Indigenous Studies School here and elsewhere was active not only in creating their own majors and curriculum, but also getting that into the other disciplines across the university. That had pretty major effects at UWA. To kind of just be watchers in the background around, you know, the kind of knowledge production that was happening about us, without us. I was doing this as well when I was studying, to turn up to lectures that were, you know, by people that we're talking about Aboriginal people with very little engagement with Indigenous knowledge holders. So playing that kind of role of just keeping an eye on what was going on across the knowledge production at a university. And I think that's had really wonderful flow-on effects.
What was the power then of the success of those trailblazers, those radicals, those activists, of which you continue the tradition?
I think I see it in my classes today. I teach in the Indigenous Studies major at UWA, and I think a lot of our Indigenous students can come to class now and feel really confident in sharing their knowledge in a way that I didn't quite have that confidence when I was coming through, because they sort of know that their peers have not had a perfect education by any means, but there's at least a greater safety around being able to share that important knowledge. And half the time they end up teaching the class with me because they come from the places I'm talking about. I teach a course on histories of colonization in the Northwest. So a good third of the room are people who come from those families. So that's really, it's co-production. It's not about the teacher and the students. And so I think that's a quite different space than I experienced.
So that's a massive paradigm shift in itself, if you're co-teaching with your students, isn't it? That's a real sense that, well, we can all be keepers of knowledge, and knowledge can co-evolve and be a relationship between the learner and the teacher.
Absolutely. It's all very relational, based on relationships. And a lot of our Indigenous students don't come through the traditional pathway to access university, but they come with this immense knowledge that's come from their communities and families and work experience and other things. And those skills are highly applicable to higher education. Sometimes they've been overlooked in the high school level, but I think they can realise that there is an appreciation for these styles of knowing things.
Balgur scholar Dr. Jessica Hutchins, who is co-director of the Burnt Museum at the University of Western Australia. On ABC Radio National's Big Ideas, can we distinguish between useful and useless knowledge in universities? You know, governments and universities increasingly seem to be doing that when they decide what research to fund, what courses to hike the hex fees up on, what subjects to offer or schools to shut down. Also joining me, Natasha Mitchell, is the director of the Institute of Advanced Studies at the University of Western Australia, the pioneering artist scholar Oren Katz, and former founding director of the Institute and book publisher Terri-Ann White. And now back to Jessica Hutchins. You did a really interesting PhD. Tell us what you did, because there's the idea of useless knowledge, but then there's also the idea of useless time, and that you would send people away on a sabbatical to indulge themselves and waste their time, and for it to have no financial or practical outcome, but they're just enhancing their own minds. Tell us about what you studied and why you did it.
I studied art history here at UWA, but I was always interested in the kind of institutions that run the art world. And I became interested in these programs called artist residencies, which many of you may have heard about, but they're essentially programs often attached to other institutions that allow artists time and space to develop work, sometimes tied to an outcome, but the ones I was looking at were ones that really allowed, this kind of useless time potentially. And I guess I had been exposed to this kind of outlandish idea that artists could just be given this completely free time.
Completely outlandish.
And was interested in why this had sprung up. They kind of really started to proliferate around the world in the 1990s and even more so in recent decades. And this seemed to be a bit of a response to the very hyper-mobile, hyper-busy lives that we're all living and the pressure on artists in particular.
And it could be said of an artist residency, as it could be said of a scholar's sabbatical, that it's a waste of time, that it's a waste of money, that there's no utility in what they're doing. How does rest of society benefit from an artist going off on a residency like that? And what are their KPIs? Thank you very much. So how do those themes pop up in your analysis of the benefit of time out, time away?
I think you just get so many artists singing the praises of the residencies that they've done as being completely formative to later major works, and so many institutions choosing to run them as part of how they develop works. But yeah, there's a lot of skepticism even in the art world of residency hopping artists who are maybe just like the equivalent of backpackers going around and around the world. But I think the proof is in how much they did proliferate over these decades. And every time we think about trying to develop something with artists, we think about adding a residency program now, and they've popped up in every institution you can imagine. So
we're talking about the usefulness of useless time in a way. And yet people might push back and go, well, why should the public purse fund an artist to indulge themselves in such a way? I'm being a provocateur here, but that argument can be made as we see the whittling away of artistic pursuits and cultural institutions in Australia.
Well, there's not that much public funding for residencies, unfortunately, is one answer. And lots of sources and lots of artists even self-funding to kind of just do more like subsidised situations, which I actually quite disagree with. I think if you're going to support artists, you have to really support them. But I kind of agree with Oren. I think we should be building societies where everybody gets to have a residency of sorts in their own lives, in terms of we should be able to build in frivolous creative time into our lives. I'm not sure how to make that happen, but I also think that artists tend to give back a lot in these residencies as well. There tends to be quite a lot of engagement in the setting that they're in. They make institutional changes. They work often in quite a socially informed way. They don't have to, but that's often what the result is and why institutions favour doing them as well.
Oren, what do you think the role of a university is?
So first of all, it's part of society.
In the 21st century.
Yeah. So going back to what Ariane said, basically, university should be part of society, not part of the economy. If we agree for that basically we are a pillar of society that actually serves society by allowing this build-up of knowledge that may or may not be useful later on. I think we're actually facing a really interesting time. AI might give us a great opportunity because AI thinks fast. We should allow universities to let us think slow and let us think sideways and let us think in ways that the AI could never copy us. So what we are facing now, and I think this is a wake-up call, actually the other day I was also part of a meeting around AI in education, this notion that we should stop teaching our students to do what the AI can do better, we can teach them how to do it different. And I think this is really a great time. So I'm a reformist in a sense. And following what Flexner actually did a survey of the medical schools in America, and as a result, 12 of them shut down. Yeah, I'm not saying that that's what we should do, but I'm saying that it's a really amazing time to think about how the university of the second half of the 21st century should look like, and it should be very different than what we see now. But it's not just up to me to make this choice, the decisions.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that you think they should be, you know, vesicles for the cultivation of original knowledge, original thinking. But for many centuries, that's what they were. and they were quarantined from the rest of society. And could it be argued that universities need to have a relationship with the rest of society? Otherwise, they're these elite, uninformed institutions.
So that's where I differ from Flexner. Flexner was actually saying the Institute of Advanced Study is like monastery for scientists and scholars. They shouldn't interact with society. He was against public engagement. He actually blocked Einstein from meeting Roosevelt when he arrived because he told Roosevelt back, no, he's too busy doing his thing. He doesn't have time to meet you and engage with you, you know, as a representative of the public. So here I differ because I think actually Institute of Advanced Studies are precious places. But they're also very much around this idea of doing stuff like what we see here tonight. Yeah, this notion of engaging the public in many different ways. You know, when we bring people through the Institute, the requirement is that they would engage in at least one public-facing event to allow this dissemination of knowledge. So it's not that we are divorced, we're not this complete ivory tower, and we are a place where knowledge is being produced, but also knowledge is being disseminated to society in ways that you know, curious people can come. And you know, I would put my limit, if you're curious, you're welcome.
Just to come back to you, do you place different value on applied knowledge in universities, the pursuit of applied knowledge? I'm speaking as someone who graduated from engineering back in the day.
Yeah, so it's kind of an interesting case. So just going back to also what Jessica was saying before, I had this really amazing conversation with Martin Kemp, who's this art historian from Oxford that specializes in Leonardo. And he was talking about this idea that art, but in this case we can talk about knowledge in general, in or kind of this useless knowledge, doesn't have a utility but has a function. And I think we need to concentrate on that function. I think that's what universities should do. I think TAFE can do a really good job at, you know, the American administration wants to make universities now into vocational education places. Yeah, we need people to obviously acquire skills and jobs.
So you don't think universities should be places of vocational education?
I think that can be a part of it, but I think the majority of what universities should do, especially in the higher levels, and allowing people the time, so even engineers can have a year off where they can engage in a curiosity-based research. That would change. That would, you know, we talked about useless time. The time when people are the most productive is when they're not engaging directly with what they're doing, especially when it comes to intellectual labor. You need the time off. You need to take your dogs for a walk. You need to go. So this is kind of a long dog walk.
Yeah.
So we need to allow those opportunities. I'm not saying that everyone should do it all the time.
What's the inherent value of being allowed to pursue one's curiosity?
That's what makes us humans.
What do you think of that, Jessica?
Well, I mean, a lot of the work I do at the university is as co-director of the Burnt Museum with my colleague Stephen Gilchrist, and most of the work we do is with communities that are not part of the university, but their belongings are cared for here at UWA, and they are knowledge holders that belong to those materials, and those materials belong to them, and that museum becomes a major access point to these incredible, you know, learnings that we can have with these people that come to visit their heritage and then can pass on to students. And that's really just one small example of things we should be doing to bring other kinds of knowledge into the academy.
What sorts of objects?
Wow. Well, there's 30,000.
30,000.
Sorry, 13,000.
13,000.
But 30,000 archive records. But oh, it ranges from really deep time objects that have come from archaeological digs and were traded through to contemporary art and really recent acquisitions. And we work with contemporary artists and cover the breadth of Australia as well as Papua New Guinea and parts of Asia. But, you know, an Indigenous object, if you take something as, you know, like a stone tool, every part of it comes with its own knowledge, where the wood came from, where the kangaroo sinew was collected, the resin that holds it together, what type of stone is used, and protocols around how to collect it and who can collect it. So it opens up a whole network of knowledge between these materials and the people that are linked through them, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does.
Overcomplicated it.
No, it totally
but
makes sense.
But each thing is a world unto itself.
All those streams of knowledge in that one object and its many stories.
This is ABC Radio National's Big Ideas. I'm Natasha Mitchell. I'm coming to you from the University of Western Australia with this live event, and we're considering the future of curiosity-driven research and learning on the corporatised campuses of Australian universities with artist Oren Katz, publisher Terry-Ann White, and art historian Jessica Hutchins.
Are universities facing an existential crisis right now? On the one hand, they are training worker bees, future worker bees, to do practical things in the world to increase Australia's productivity. On the other hand, they are also academies. They are the holders of knowledge. They are the creators and makers of knowledge that might never go anywhere, but still build the human, collective human consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think they are.
So what is at the heart of that existential crisis?
I think it's about the priorities of making bigger, better, more streamlined institutions rather than having a bit of play between the people who work in them. You know, the idea of how much time many students have with people who are not in full-time and properly paid jobs of teaching. You know, I went through university, and you probably did too, in a golden age of...
I don't know, they introduced HECS when I went through, so that was the Dawkins reforms had arrived.
Okay.
There's been a mass casualisation of the education workforce inside universities.
Correct.
So they are in a constant state of flux, instability, fear for their jobs.
Yeah.
And I just do wonder where they can get then the headspace, the time, the sense of security to do deep thinking.
Well, I don't think they do. If you're in a casualised job and you're servicing a lot of students... And particularly after COVID, where we all became somewhat discombobulated, it's a very tough gig. When I came to this university, I mean, we all had lunch in the same couple of places. And so I could have access to the Vice Chancellor as a junior academic. I don't know, everything about it was golden. And, you know, I'm probably romanticising a bit. But I see most of the friends I have who are working in universities have barely any kind of sense of security because the workforces are reducing. Departments and schools are being closed down. Everything's being managed in a way that doesn't give a lot of room for those extraordinary discussions that you can have over lunch or in someone's office where you share the knowledge of your field with others.
Oren Katz, we are experiencing a time where universities are shutting down whole specialties, shutting down schools, departments, kind of wiping the slates clean of entire disciplines in some cases. Subjects always come and go at universities, but whole subject areas are being deleted. And so... We live in an interesting time, and there is a value judgment being made there, isn't there, on what knowledge is useful and what knowledge is useless. But also, do we have to recognise that times change, that students and their interests change, that scholarship shifts and evolves, that the disciplines of old might not be relevant in the way that they were in the past?
Yeah, I suppose to a large extent, that's one way of putting it. I think my concern, and this is, again, something we're trying to push very hard in our institute, and this is something that, talking to other heads of Institute of One Studies, the idea of interdisciplinarity. If you don't have those other disciplines to engage with, you lose that very important part, the build-up of this joint knowledge of those different disciplines. So I'm not talking about the undergraduate level, not even the postgraduate. It's the level where researchers from different knowledge systems can come together and talk to each other and come up with new knowledge that could never be achieved otherwise. And by removing those bases, the foundation of knowledge, we are going to lose a lot of it. And by removing the ability of scholars to engage in interdisciplinary research, we are going to lose a lot of opportunities of what might wait for us over the horizon. So that's where I see more of the problem. Yeah, we can maybe lose a language, which is a shame, and it's a great shame, which means that there's a part of human knowledge that is going to disappear. But if it's systematic, then it's an extreme problem for us and for our future.
Yeah. What would you like to see change in the way that we value knowledge in this country and inside universities?
So first of all, more public support. It's always great, you know, in the sense of basically understanding that our role is not just to be an economic engine, which universities are regardless. And this is the other thing is like this. And again, this is an argument Flaxner is saying. It's like we are in the commercial world, people are taking risks and are willing to lose money. How come we're not allowing it to do with knowledge where we are willing to explore areas that might not yield anything useful now? It might be useful 100 years from now. You talked about KPIs. KPIs are always like what happened like last week. How can we allow for like a 100-year KPI? Actually, Flexner is talking about some discoveries that took 100 years to actually eventuate into something useful. If we don't allow that to happen in 100 years' time, we will look around us and everything would be the same if at all. So I think we need to allow this deep thinking, long thinking, slow thinking, and universities are the only place in the world where we can actually do it. And to get a license to do it, I suppose this is what we're playing here, give us the social license to be able to continue doing that.
Jessica, what would you like to see prioritised in Australia and inside universities when we think about this idea of knowledge and what we value and what we don't?
Yeah, I absolutely agree with Oren. I do think it's about all of those relationships we can have at an institution as large as a university across departments and disciplines and colleagues and students. I mean, to go back to what Terri-Ann was talking about in terms of that incredible social world that used to exist at the university, it's been massively cut into with casualised staff, but also students who are often having to work a couple of jobs on the side. I see my students really coming in and out, which is really sad because they would benefit so much from that additional social time. And
there's no campus community anymore.
There still is a really vibrant one, but it's up against it, all these other time pressures that students are under. They don't get to waste the kind of time that I wasted at university. And I do think that's a place where Indigenous knowledge can thrive as well, one that's truly relational and where you can actually build up relationships meaningfully and slowly, and that's where the really interesting knowledge comes about.
Director of the Burnt Museum, art historian and Indigenous studies scholar, Dr. Jessica Hutchins. And now to audience questions at this event at the University of Western Australia, starting with one from the university's Deputy Vice-Chancellor Research, Professor Anna Novak, who introduced the event.
Thank you. We've heard a lot about how universities have changed in a way that may not always be welcome, but could you talk us through for a moment what government policy and funding has done that might have led to the changes, and so which actually is the chicken and which is the egg?
It's a great question.
Yeah, yes.
This is the boss asking the staff member.
It's not your fault, Anna.
It's the government. Maybe I should come back to you.
Yeah, but the really interesting thing, and this is part of the whole, we kind of embedded some of this in our conversation before, this notion of universities being seen by the government as being part of the economy rather than part of the society, and therefore the type of investment into universities is becoming very, very different. It's not an investment into our future, it's an investment into basically a service that we are providing for individuals, and that's not what university is supposed to be. It's about community service and how we can convince politicians that's above my pay grade, but the fact is that you're right. Funding was cut, universities were sent out to look for their own funds, and that's what led to the increase of international students, not to increase our kind of pool of knowledge, but as increase funding to the university to be able to sponsor other activities. You would know better than I do that research is now seems like as a strange add-on rather than the core of what universities should do. And I think that should change, because if we want to be an international player, Australia really need to invest much, much more in research. And research seems to be cut across the board, not just within universities, but also R&D investments in Australia is dropping. You know, we need to somehow convince our politicians that short returns are not the way, that if we want, and again, thinking about the long future. So it's not the fault of the universities as such, but it's how we as a university can stand up and argue for the value of what we're doing beyond just the economic value. And that's a problem. I've seen it in the art as well, where artists need to somehow justify their existence and what they're doing as people, what they're contributing to society in terms, you know, okay, I might be fired, not from here, but Western Australia changed the name. There's no art anymore in government, it's creative industries. What the hell is that? Culture is not an industry, yeah? So how can we convince that we need to somehow look at the non-monetary value of our actions in a way that would actually allow the prosperity of our culture and our society?
I just want to also acknowledge the incredible contribution that overseas students make to university communities as well. And they often struggle with feeling exploited for their fees as well and not getting the sort of tuition that they need to best support their learning. So I just want to acknowledge that. You've got a question.
Yes, I do. Hi, my name's Mariette. I've been working in the entertainment industries for a few years now for stage and screen. I think that the freelancer mindset has kind of eroded many conversations that I've been having with people, especially when they're building up their portfolio. And a lot of musing conversations about life and anything really, in a lot of ways have degraded and turned into a personal representation of like their own portfolio. So my question is, how do we save entertainment and keep it curious and keep it alive and asking odd questions when it is being degraded by this personal freelance mindset of needing to keep productive?
I sense a bit of heartache some sadness there, this sense that people are chasing content for their CVs. Yes. And it's a very cutthroat sort of industry, isn't it? So a lot of competition.
Not much space for just being quite random, and much to my mother's, she has to put up with me, but I'm a very big advocate of non-ending musing.
Yeah. Great question. Who'd like to pick that up?
What do you mean by entertainment? I'm actually a bit confused there.
I studied to do design for performance and have worked for like screen and theatre.
Can you call it art instead?
It depends.
All right.
I think that to my understanding and in a lot of the conversations that I've had, you either get big screen roles in which you are working as a tiny cog and not really part of anything. And if you bring up ideas that might be slightly a bit out there, then you might not be as useful to the industry and very easy to get rid of. And if you're working in small projects, generally the funding is terrible and they strip you quite bare. And I've have so many people, so many great people that I know who have health conditions that are degrading if they're taking part in these smaller productions that don't pay them well.
Oh, you are speaking so many people's truths in the creative sector. Oren.
You know, the interesting thing, I think it's a parallel conversation to what we had now, because without experimental art, without kind of the idea of artists working on those small projects without much reward, but out of passion and out of curiosity and out of wanting to develop something without necessarily even wanting to have a huge audience, but engaging in this exploratory, curiosity-based form of art, large-scale entertainment would never happen. And this is exactly kind of what we're arguing for in regard to the knowledge production, that without those things that seems useless at the beginning or not really connected or not well rewarding, we would never be able to reach the top. Yeah. So I would say actually stick for the small production. Those experiments, take risks.
Pay, Oren.
And find a way to pay your rent. Yeah.
You need
but
to continue
again,
this conversation.
I think we as a society need to acknowledge the importance of those kind of activities. And again, yeah, we complain about the fact that we don't really have much funding in Australia for the arts, and we're still relatively healthy. You know, I've been to other places in the world where artists are not paid at all, but they're still doing art because they feel that they're driven to do it. And those are the people that we need to nurture somehow, either here or elsewhere. Yeah.
Thank you.
So I really love the concept and the idea that it all comes from muck. Out of the muck comes the useless knowledge, and out of the useless knowledge comes the useful knowledge. And then underpinning all of this is curiosity and a kind of deep connection to the human conditions. And my question is, in a a world of fake truth and blandness, how do you cultivate your curiosity gene?
Terri-Ann.
Well, largely by finding your community. You know, working within a broad and diverse community, it might be tiny, but to be able to bounce ideas off, to be able to take extraordinary risks, you know, everything upended is the way to go. And to keep reading.
And stop scrolling. Yeah.
And stop scrolling. Yeah. Oh, the addiction, yeah. It's real.
It's a little bit left beam. Do you believe that universities have not actually taken up the what we call the social and cultural disruptions? Does that make sense to you?
Explain it just briefly a bit more.
When, like for instance, the AI that's happening now, which is a social and cultural disruption and it's worldwide, it has impacted, as you're saying, with your arts and media and things like that. Do you think universities act quickly enough to generate the discussion around that, how it impacts on people? Does it create opportunity to debate about it? All those sorts of things.
Yeah, interesting question.
I think there's something true in the sense that we need to build slow time into universities and allow for it. But I think that's what would allow universities to actually be able to respond quicker as well. In the sense that I feel like we're kind of numbed out from being able to respond in the kind of culture we're building. And the ability to think and act quickly, to come together through the building of social spaces, to have that real political dialogue that I think universities used to have a lot more, has to be cemented in that social life of the university.
Well, on that note, I think we should go and celebrate 25 years of the Institute of Advanced Studies. Please thank Oren Katz, Jessica Hutchins and Terri-Ann White. And this event, it was organised by the University of Western Australia's Institute of Advanced Studies to mark its 25th anniversary. And it featured the Institute's current director, the pioneering artist and founder of Symbiotica, the Centre of Excellence in Biological Arts, Associate Professor Oren Katz, former founding director of the Institute, Terri-Ann White, who now runs the independent publishing house Upswell, and Balgu woman, art historian and lecturer, Dr. Jessica Hutchins, co-director of the Burnt Museum. Coming up next on Big Ideas, the remarkable young leader, musician, strategist Holly Rankin, aka Jack River is her artist's name, with an address she was invited to give to federal parliament recently.
When I was 14, I lost my sister Shannon in a freak accident. Her death was followed by a 3-year coronial inquest and a 6-year-long court case. The pain and the harrow of grief, the turmoil of seeing my parents lose a child, made me want to escape my life. So I created Jack River and I built a world of song to heal myself. What followed was a community that I could never ever have dreamt of when I first took those steps of writing my life into song. Writing songs in my bedroom turned into playing to 80,000 young people in the Domain for the school strikes for climate, and 8,000 people at Splendor in the Grass singing my songs. It turned into thousands of relationships with strangers all around the country. Through watching others build their communities too, from heavy metal bands like the Amity Affliction to rappers like Briggs and pop artists like Thelma Plum, I've been a student to the art of bringing people together. Across my decade in music, I wanted to bring storytelling and culture to great political ideas and help storytellers themselves understand their own politics and be supported to lean in. But when I worked on the Voice to Parliament campaign alongside Megan Davis and Auntie Pat Anderson from 21 to 2023, I saw the potential of people and organisations, specifically organisations, to weaponise culture, storytelling, algorithms and lies to tear us apart.
Holly Rankin, next on Big Ideas. And a heads up, next week we've got acclaimed novelist. He's author of The Slap, Barracuda, The In-Between, Christos Tsolkas. He's going to be talking about fence-sitting in an era of deep division.
I came up with the idea of fence-sitting precisely because it embodied something about the necessity of doubt that I think is being lost in our current intellectual debates. in the classroom, at writers' festivals, in criticism and in journalism, doubt is viewed with suspicion, that it is always prevarication, or worst, as compliance. In choosing as my theme fence sitting, I wanted to advocate for a position of doubt as thoughtfulness, as attention. And I wanted to be playful. I started with a draft that took a moment from my childhood when I was a very young boy in inner city Melbourne, such a long time ago that the inner city was both working class and migrant. I was going to tell you the story of the back fence of our house, made of old wood palings that seemed so enormous to me as a little child. I was envious of older cousins who managed to scale the fence, whose feet magically found the exact right spot on the horizontal plank, and with one powerful exertion, they would grab the top of the fence, hoist themselves up, and drop to the other side. And they would disappear. How I used to envy them. The fence was a marker between infancy and something elusive, both tantalising and frightening, something called growing up. I was going to tell you of that magical day that my arms and legs suddenly found strength, and though I slipped a few times, though I got a splinter in the pad of one of my fingers, I finally had climbed that fence. And tell you of the excitement I had felt sitting on the boundary between home and the world beyond. I remember looking down, and there was terror at how immense, how frightening the drop to the alley below seemed. My cousins were calling out, "Jump, Crystal, jump!" And I wanted to tell you of something magical I saw atop of the old fence in Richmond. Across from our house, on the other side of the alley, there were a block of flats. I knew the alley and I knew those flats. We played footy in the alley as kids, both Aussie footy and real footy, as my parents called soccer. And we played cricket there, which neither of my parents understood. I'd even hidden on the concrete stairwell to the flats during a game of hide and seek. Yet on top of that fence, I suddenly found that I could look across to the windows on the other side, see into a bedroom and into a small galley kitchen. There were colourful ceramic cats piled on the sill. Years later, watching Hitchcock's masterpiece Rear Window on the TV, I found myself jolted upright, the memory of my first climb flooding back. I hadn't seen a murder. I hadn't even seen a human being in the flats. Yet sitting there atop of the fence, I had an inkling that there were stories to be told. I wondered who lay on that single bed. Who was it that loved cats so much? My cousins were still calling for me to jump. I closed my eyes, gripped the fence, and I jumped. So that moment was going to be the beginning of the talk. Yet something happened as I started taking notes, sifting through memories, starting to write these paragraphs. I received a flurry of texts from someone who used to be a friend for over 30 years. He had read the subject of my lecture tonight and he was furious with me. "So that's what you've become, Cholkas," he began. "A fucking sellout, too scared to take sides." The message finished in triumphant indignation. "Well, we all now know the coward you have become." The words "now" and "coward" were capitalised, and the sentence completed with a flourish of exclamation marks, those ubiquitous markers of outrage and bile for keyboard warriors. I'm not a fool. I understand very well the provocation in the subject of this talk. There is carnage in Gaza, and alongside it, there is an upswelling of anti-Semitism that has shocked me in its ferocity, its poisonous tenacity. 2 weeks ago, there were fascists marching in my city, fascists who violently attacked a camp set up to proclaim the historic sovereignty of Aboriginal peoples on this land. The world is burning. Authoritarians are in power the world over, and I want to talk about sitting on the fence. My friend's venom was a howl. How dare you?
And listen out for novelist Christos Cholkas with a very personal take on the role of fence sitting in a time of difficulty and division. That's next week on Big Ideas. I'm Natasha Mitchell. Thanks for listening to Big Ideas. You can find all our episodes on the ABC Listen app, of course, or wherever you find your podcasts, except Spotify, I might add. Our email address for your feedback or to pitch forthcoming events to us is bigideas@abc.net.au. And I'll catch you next time. for more big ideas.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.